From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Civil rights have come a long way from the days of Martin Luther King and his dream, but over the past year and a half, with Ferguson and Baltimore and more, many around the country are alert in a new way to racial realities. Protesters have been out in the streets, at campaign rallies, and on college campuses shouting, "Black Lives Matter." We want to look at where this new round of anger and awareness have brought us. This hour On Point, celebrated poet Claudia Rankine and Black Lives Matter activist DeRay McKesson on race realities now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. After Ferguson and Baltimore and Chicago and all the rest, what have you seen? What have you learned? What is needed right now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Again and again around the country, we've seen all kinds of issues being raised, some of them old and very familiar, some for some new or newly clarified by folks who are out and just not ready to take it anymore. Here were protesters in the streets of Chicago scuffling with police. This is on a cell phone video after video of the shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald was released in late November. Again and again in the last year and a half. Here we are on Martin Luther King Day, now 2016, looking at where this edge of awareness, readiness to change, maybe moving, maybe going. Joining me from Baltimore is poet Claudia Rankine. Her most recent collection, Citizen, an American Lyric, was finalist for the 2014 National Book Award, won the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award, the NAACP Image Award, and lots of high praise. Claudia Rankine, it's terrific to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
It's really, really great to have you. And from Washington, DeRay McKesson is with us, civil rights activist and Black Lives Matter organizer, a prominent voice emerging from the last year and more of uproar and reassessment. DeRay McKesson, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tom, thanks for the invite. It's good to be here.
We'll get the poet's view, DeRay, but let me come first to you. What are we learning in this last year and a half? Is it something you didn't already know, or is it just white America being awakened to levels of discomfort and imposition that maybe they were very ready to look past, look beyond?
Yeah, I think what the movement did is it rendered visible things that had seemingly been invisible in the public space. It's that we knew the trauma that the police had inflicted in communities of color for a long time, but now we got to amplify it and tell it to people in ways that we never could before, right? So social media allowed us to tell it and to show it in ways that we couldn't. So I think about being in St. Louis a year ago is that if we had not had Twitter, the Missouri police, Missouri would have convinced you that we just didn't exist. And because of the tools we have now, we've been able to organize and amplify messages in new and powerful ways.
Here's Opal Tometi, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, talking with Vice about the movement in this produced package. This is from just last month.
This year for the movement has been phenomenal. We've seen people who are incredibly courageous rise up and take to the streets. You know, we're seeing every 28 hours an unarmed black person being murdered. And our communities are tired of it. And so what we've seen in 2015 is the real deep cry of a people that says enough.
Opal Tometi, co-founder of Black Lives Matter right there. Claudia Rankine, I'm so curious how you as a poet see this. You've been writing about, for years, many of the dynamics that are now being put so far forward in the national conversation. They've been your subject for a long, long time in poems that, you know, have a very good readership, but nothing like the evening news or nothing like Twitter. How's it feel to see these being brought forward in full glare now, Claudia?
Well, you know, a long time ago, Martin Luther King said that one of the problems was that technology was outpacing our culture. And to have, as DeRay says, technology enabling the recognition of what has been going on all along is fantastic.
Does it make poetry seem like it needs to be tweeted?
Well, the thing is, it doesn't make anything seem like anything. It just is. Social media, if someone likes a poem, it is tweeted. If somebody reads a book that they like, it's on Facebook. So social media in its way, has connected us in a way that I don't think one could have imagined, say, back in 1950s or 60s when King was bemoaning the fact that we were interrelated without understanding our interrelatedness.
When things go public in such a big way, when they become part of this public conversation, they're often changed just by the way they're presented there, how they hit the public consciousness. I mean, I've loved reading in Citizen, in your American lyric style, your very nuanced and subtle presentation of these things, many of these dynamics for a long time. And I wonder how you as a poet are watching the way these issues have hit the national stage. Do they look true to your poetic perception over time? Do they look like they've been warped or distorted as they've gone up to the big, big stage, Claudia?
No, I think that every vantage point allows for the full picture. So as a writer and as a poet, I'm really interested in language and the nuances of language and what it means to say, what gets said. You know, for example, when Darren Wilson said that Michael Brown was reminded him of Hulk Hogan, that to me is something to think about and move forward with. But what happens on Twitter and what Black Lives Matter did to that moment is a whole other kind of dimension to bringing attention to these matters. So I don't think it's one or the other. It just becomes a whole cultural push forward, which is incredibly important to our time.
DeRay, when Martin Luther King was leading the civil rights movement, voting rights was right there front and center as a gigantic issue. Of course, there were many others, fair pay that he was raising in Memphis and beyond. Sometimes today, there are still very clear and strong issues, but then there are many, much more subtle things that are now getting a kind of national workout. How do you see the top of the list of issues that this last year and a half has raised? What would you put up there, I don't know, in the top three, four?
Well, with regard to race, I think that it's clearly been a conversation about having a broader understanding of safety that doesn't center the police, right? Like, how can we think about what it means to have safe communities that doesn't require police presence, that isn't predicated on the presence of police? You think about the Upper West Side, you think about Georgetown and D.C., they are safe not because they're flooded with police officers, but because they are resourced differently.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that there are a host of conversations about the criminal justice system writ large, right, with the new sentencing bill. And then one of the things that it was beautiful that came out of the protests and the space and community that was created is a renewed focus on identity and the complexity of blackness and conversations about the nuances of identity. So conversations around the trans community are public in ways that they have never been before, and deep and rich community buildings happening around the identity work that hasn't happened in the public sphere like this before.
Claudia, are you surprised to see issues of sexuality merging in this sort of intersectional, seems to be the term of art now, into the race conversation? Is that surprising? Is that welcome? How do you look at it?
Well, I look at it in terms of people, and the trans community is part of the American community. So it makes complete sense to me, and perhaps is belated when you think about the kind of violence that is inside queer communities for such a long time. I would also add to DeRay's list that I think what we have now is a new emphasis on gun control, which I think is really important, because racism and systemic racism is there and it's huge. But what makes our society so different is the proliferation of guns. And also this issue of surveillance and bringing cameras into communities and which way they go, you know, whether or not it really will affect how justice plays out with the police, or if it's another way of monitoring the communities that will be under surveillance, in a sense. So, I think all of these other kinds of issues are coming up as well.
I don't know how you define this chapter, when it begins. I mean, Trayvon Martin's death certainly kicked off a lot of reflection and protest. Here we are, you know, a couple of years and more into that. Do you see the perceptions that are gaining such wider currency now as moving toward change this time, Claudia? Or is it just a big national talking shop?
Well, I think, oh gosh, you know, there's so many ways to be depressed or disappointed by what's happening around the justice system relative to many of these murders. But I think that when you think about the kind of participatory culture that movements like Black Lives Matter has put in place, you can't help but be pleased by that, that everybody's showing up and showing up in terms of dialogue and in terms of a kind of peer-based interactive groupings to affect change. And I think people will come out even more during the election, or at least I hope so, in the name of these issues. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's complicated.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking on Martin Luther King Day at the end of a turbulent year, 2 years on race, about justice, equity, black lives now, where we are as a country, with prize-winning poet Claudia Rankin, chronicler of everyday racism, and Black Lives Matter organizer, activist DeRay McKesson. You can join us this hour. What are we working through in this chapter, on this front, in the year and a half since Ferguson? After the shootings and the protests, the uproar, do we change? What's your personal experience of race lately, race relations? Is it, are they changing? DeRay McKesson points to social media. We have seen things in the last year from dashboard cams and more that are just utterly arresting. Here's that conversation from July between Texas Trooper Brian Encinia and Sandra Bland down for a job interview. Escalating here as he orders her to get out of her car. He pulled over for not using a lane change signal captured on dash cam video.
Get out of the car.
You know that you
get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said
for your
get
failure?
Out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order.
Door. You
I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car.
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get over there.
The whole country watching and listening, eyes wide open. And, of course, within a day, she, very sadly, dead in jail there in Texas. Black Lives Matter activists around the country, even in the midst of the presidential primary campaign, not taking silence for a path here. After storming the stage at a Bernie Sanders rally in Seattle in August, here was Marissa Johnson, identifies herself as a Black Lives Matter activist, calling for a moment of silence in the crowd to remember the teenager whose death had earlier sparked outrage.
We're going to honor the memory of Michael Brown, and we're going to honor all of the black lives lost this year, and we're going to honor the fact that I have to fight through all these people who said, my life matters! That I have to get up here in front of a bunch of screaming white racists.
People speaking up, speaking out. Claudia Rankin has had her finger on the pulse of this in beautiful poetry for a long time, powerful poetry, Citizen and American Lyric, out in 2014, prize winner on many fronts. She joins us from Baltimore. DeRay McKesson, civil rights activist, Black Lives Matter organizer, with us from Washington. Let's bring our listeners right in here from Detroit. Braxton's calling. Braxton, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for accepting my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're at a point to where, as we understand that excessive force is a reality and that is heightened, usually, you know, when it comes to minorities. However, I think that we're at a point to where we, as far as solutions to where Black Lives Matter is Monday through Friday at schools and elementary schools and going to PTA meetings and having this organized protest just for more engagement in our own community.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we highlight the reality of excessive force, we have to highlight the reality of being going scared to the gas station and getting robbed. And so, in my opinion, the controversy is where our black professionals and academia have to put themselves in uncomfortable situations where the local activists are, the people that know the community, and have a presence that's stronger than the negative presence.
And what do you mean by putting themselves in uncomfortable situations, Braxton? What would that look like to you?
It looks like, all right, when you have a culture change, that means you have to change culture. So if somebody, say, a student, an eighth grader is getting ready to maybe participate in, say, THC marijuana, being able to infiltrate and say, hold up, maybe you should go to school first. Maybe you should study first. That's interacting and breaking a normal habit, but you have to have the influence and the consistency to be able to influence a person's behavior.
Braxton, I appreciate your call. Dere McKesson, sort of two fronts there. I mean, one is more focused. All right, the issue of excessive police force has been raised in a lot of these cases. What do we do about it? Bernie Sanders last night talking about federal investigation every time there is a death in police custody. Our Detroit caller is saying, well, where is the action on that front? And then, you know, this notion of kind of a culture change requiring the constant calling out of dynamics, the constant intervention. Is there the energy and the sort of model for how to do that out there across the country, Dere?
Yeah, so protesters across the country have demands and have had them. I think about our meetings with Bernie and Hillary and Loretta Lynch and Valerie Jarrett in the White House. So we launched a comprehensive platform around ending police violence called Campaign Zero, and it's at joincampaignzero.org. But it talks about a range of things, from an increased standard for use of force to independent investigators to also looking at police union contracts that protect so many of the behaviors that lead to violence from the police and communities. And to the second point, it's not an either or, right? So people are engaged in their communities. People are going to PTA meetings. The reality, though, is that I shouldn't have to go to a PTA meeting for the police like not to kill me, right? That people are working on both of the issues. And people set up this false choice where it's like either you focus on the PTA or do quote whatever's in your community or you don't really care or something like that. And, you know, people have been doing work around community violence. People have been doing work on education for years. And people are now talking about the police in public spheres. And that's really important because the police are like a gateway to talking about state violence and the ways that it manifests in communities, specifically communities of color. So I don't buy that the way he chose to frame it. But I will say people have been working on these issues and continue to.
Claudia, do you see police violence as kind of a... I don't know, the magic ring here. If you grapple with that, state violence, as Dere McKesson calls it, is it effectively at the root of much else?
Well, I think it's one dynamic, an important one, because it leads to a kind of alienation in the communities. And then when you have the alienation, you have a lack of value for the community itself. So if you believe that you're going to be killed for walking in the middle of the street, then you don't value and have no investment, you know, you don't have investment in the next day or the next year. So it's a very sort of intertwined dynamic that has been put in place over centuries. And to think that at any moment we could right the ship by focusing on one thing, the PTA or the police, I think is a little bit disingenuous or
impossible, maybe.
Impossible.
You know, your antenna are always so far out looking at even the most intimate personal interactions. And I wonder, Claudia, if you see these big sort of bullhorn themes working their way into more intimate interactions between Americans in their private lives, the awareness of remaining injustices, the awareness of remaining discomfort that people may feel based on skin color or other differences. Do you see that beginning to seep in?
I think so. I think that dialogue is beginning to happen. I think so, and I hope so at the same time. And I think that a lot of what we believe begins around the dinner table. And, you know, we trust, or we don't even trust, we hear, and we take it in. And before we know it, it is what we are saying and believing and responding to. So, you know, any move that allows for discourse and allows for education of what is really going on will shift the paradigms, I believe.
We soak it in, we soak it up, but we also know that we're good at denial. I guess everybody, denial. We're humans, we're good at denial. Sal in Burlington, Vermont. Sal, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for my call. I have one comment. I was watching a program with my niece who happens to be 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Julia. And I asked her to explain the program we were watching. There was four children. One was black, one was white, one was Asian, the other one was Hispanic. She pointed out the boy in the red shirt. She did not say the black boy. When I heard that, it dawned on me, wow, she doesn't understand this black and white thing. And I thought that was wonderful. She looked at him as a person, not a black person. Like, she didn't label him. And to me, that spoke volume to me. And then it dawned on me, as she gets older, and more of the programs that she watches change, that's going to change. Because of, I feel that it needs to stop being a black and white issue, and people just need to be people. Or a woman, or a man, or a person, so that these young people today can grow up thinking that way.
Sal, I understand that hope exactly, and I know what you're describing in younger Americans, and who doesn't want to see or hope that that's the direction we're headed in? On the other hand, there's been talk about color blindness. Sometimes it hasn't really panned out for people of color. I mean, Doreen McKesson, what about this idea that demographically, culturally, we remain headed toward a time when these lines of color are just less important, that new generations may look straight past them? How about it? Do you buy it?
Yes, I think that what Sal highlights is something that Claudia also notes, right? This idea that we learn how to talk about issues of race, or this is learned behavior, racism, and things like that. I think that the goal is to get to a place where race isn't coded with normative values, right? Where being black is not a good or bad thing, or whiteness doesn't confer benefits of humanity that other races don't have, but allows still for deep cultural resonance. Because what we know is that there are beautiful things about the cultures of so many people. I mean, we should celebrate those things. They should not come with normative values, right? That being black is not a bad thing. Being white is not necessarily a good thing. That we can appreciate the cultural resonance that people bring to spaces and the beauty there without attaching value judgments.
Claudia, can we have culture without normative values?
I don't think so.
No,
I mean, I don't think that we can get there from where we've come. I think that to say that we can stop history and start again, create a kind of break, mm-hmm. I would love that. And if it were possible, I think it might have happened. But we have history. And we will always have it, and we will always look back to it. There will always be a continuity. And so we will always be shifting. There will always be power dynamics. There will always be people who are ready to categorize other people and have that include the entire culture. You know, let's not name Donald Trump. And so I think that is a big ask. What we could do instead, though, mm-hmm. is begin to look at whiteness and break it apart in terms of what and how it became the
measure, the baseline.
Measure,
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the measure of all things good. And be able to understand what that narrative is, and to to unteach it. Yeah, I mean, I really think that that's where we need to start.
Isn't interrogating whiteness also working to decouple the notion that it is good, right? Like, isn't that a part of the work, Claudia?
I think so, and I think that until we can get to a place where we see human beings as human beings and everybody capable of everything, both good and bad.
I hear you on the idea that, like, it might be sort of utopic, right, to think that we can get to a place where we can celebrate culture without value judgments, which doesn't make me believe that that should not be our goal. Does that make sense? Right? That, like, I get that that work might be really hard, and it might not be a generation that you see or I see or...
Isn't even respect for all people regardless of color, that would be a value, wouldn't it, Duray?
Yeah, and we might be saying the same things differently. So, mm-hmm. Yes, I agree, right? What I'm saying is that, like, when I hear both of you talk about that, that to me is, like, respecting it is not saying that, like, one is better or worse, but that I, like, see and appreciate people for who they are, right? But without the value judgment that comes laden with people's skin color, which is what I hear when I hear Claudia talk about decoupling the things that come, the privilege that comes with whiteness, mm-hmm. And having that resonate in ways that like unshackle people or like don't negatively impact the lives of other people.
Dismantling ideas around whiteness, I mean, that's been out there for a long time, but I've never seen it so far forward in the public discourse. Doug in Iroquois Territory, New York. Doug, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Excuse me. Saginaw, which is the Mohawk word for greetings, and I hope it's peaceful within you. What's missing through all of this dialogue is, of course, any reference to Aboriginal peoples. You recall Leonardo DiCaprio cited Indigenous peoples in his acceptance speech last week, but there's no subsequent follow-up to that. And when you're speaking on matters of race, you got to know that Indigenous peoples have a legal, lawful standing that makes us distinct and unique. Article 6 of the United States Constitution says that treaties are supreme law of the land. In our opinion, unless there's reconciliation with that, unless the United States and the American people demonstrate an ability to adhere and accept their lawful obligation, that there's always going to be these fundamental problems of racial reconciliation. We have to be included in this. And at no point do I see our African-American allies ever extend their concerns to Aboriginal people, whether it's the name of the Washington Redskins or the exclusion of African-American people from award ceremonies like the Academy Awards. We're not cited in that. We're not included in that. Anybody who knows anything about North American history knows that the Aboriginal are history and that of African-American people are intertwined.
Doug, I'm so glad you raised that. Our time is short before the break. Let me raise it. Claudia Rankin, what about, I mean, there's a little suggestion there of dismantling, we talked about dismantling whiteness, but what about dismantling blackness as the normative abused party? Doug wants, you know, a wider view of voices and faces at that table.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think there's a kind of shorthand that happens around talking about blackness. And one, you know, I should say for myself, I include in that, even though the word is black, I'm thinking about all people, queer people, Aboriginal, you know, everybody. And blackness only becomes a kind of shorthand to think about what happens when you are the person who is in an oppressive system. So you're actually talking about the system and all the ways in which the system has oppressed people.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom. With a quick heads up for you, be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love, It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking on Martin Luther King Day at the end of a turbulent year, 2 years on race, about justice, equity, Black Lives Now, and more, where we are as a country, with prize-winning poet Claudia Rankine, Black Lives Matter organizer activist DeRay McKesson. In May, after Freddie Gray's death in Baltimore, here in police custody, hear the sound of protesters taking to the streets.
Hands up! Don't shoot!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
We have heard it again and again and again, and some really interesting kind of read into what it would look like if things were different. Here was the series finale of the comedy series Key and Peele. This was in September. Their final sketch was titled Negro Town, a satirical take on what life would be like if Black people had a community in which they could thrive without systematic racism. Here's a clip from Key and Peele.
You won't get followed when you try to shop.
You can't wear your hoodie and not get shot.
No white folks to cross the street in fear.
No trigger-happy cops or scared cashiers.
That loan application can't get turned down.
You always approved in Negro Town.
This is amazing.
I know, right?
Over the top, but they know how to do it. Key and Peele there in there. Finale. You can join us this hour. White listeners, are you getting it? What are you seeing through the police dashboard cameras, through the eyes of African Americans, others saying it's just not good enough yet? And no Black actor, director nominated for an Oscar, not one? What does that say in this January of 2016? We've got a Black president, a Black attorney general. Where does the next change come? Mike in Wayland, Massachusetts. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Claudia Rankine and DeRay McKesson.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me in.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely an issue of racism in the police officers shooting Black men pretty regularly, it seems like. But I think the bigger picture, or the thing that isn't discussed much, one of the candidates last night actually brought it up briefly, is these are areas where this is happening that have no jobs, have no kind of economic options. So you end up with a high crime rate. When you put people in an area where you cannot make a living, but you still must feed yourself or others, you get put in this position. So you end up with this high crime rate. So you end up with a large percentage of people in that community, in this case, Black communities. It's not, you know, it's well known that there's vast wastelands in Detroit,
yep,
and such, where there's absolutely no job availability. So you end up with a high number of Black men shot. I think the way to fix this problem, it's a three-prong attack. One is, sadly, we have to video everything. The police officers in the cars should have very good video equipment. We must have independent people who will look at an incident like this, or any incident where a firearm has been used by a police officer on any individual, as well as one of the candidates said that should trigger an investigation by the federal government into a situation like this, because I believe it Black Lives Matter, and I believe that because you'll see that. If we could do the statistics, you'll find a lot of Black police officers involved,
sure,
in what I would say questionable shootings or behavior towards other Black citizens. I myself was arrested once by a Black police officer and treated badly. And I didn't come away with that thinking it was a Black man who treated me bad. I became distrustful of police officers as a whole.
Mike, I think we got the heart of it there, where you say, look beyond the shootings themselves, look at the economic environment in which this is taking place. There are real problems there. And DeRay McKesson, as you listen to that, I wonder, are we taking on, at least rhetorically and maybe more, you heard the proposal last night from Bernie Sanders to have federal investigation anytime there's a death in custody. But are we taking on the bigger picture, or is that another level of, I don't know, hypocrisy or avoidance here if we don't get to the economy itself? And there again, it goes right beyond Black communities, of course, but certainly not least there.
Yeah, so we have to talk about economic justice, right? And we need to talk about what does it mean that when we think about impoverished communities, that much of that was intentionally done, that the projects in the communities around them were built and made to be and to function the way that they do. There is something, though, is that the data actually doesn't support this idea that the police are just where the police violence happens, where crime is, right? That there's like this deep link between community violence and police violence. There actually is no correlation between the two. So the police will tell you, you know, I was on a panel once and the police officer in the NYPD was like, DeRay, the police are where the crime is. And as if to justify it. And it was like, you know, the police aren't on Wall Street, right? And they totally should be there too. But it actually isn't supported by the data either. It's just one of those talking points and one of those things that continues to resonate with people because it anecdotally seems correct, but it actually isn't. And whether I have a job or not doesn't mean that the police should be able to harass me. But again, we should think about how to give people different economic opportunities so they can have different resources and increase their opportunity to make different choices.
I mean, I'm sure some people are going to listen to that and say, well, okay, but in a bunch of these videos coming out of Chicago, there are allegations that as these usually young people are running away and in these videos horribly shot down, the assertion is that there was some crime underway that the police are responding to. You're not buying that?
Yeah, I mean, the crime is like being black in some of these, right? And you know, that's sort of hard. So when the police narrative is the only narrative that you hear, and again, the data just doesn't support that. So I know that in some of the videos people have seen, but you think about Tamir Rice, right? There was, you know, he committed no crime. You think about, you know, Sandra Bland, I don't know what the crime was there, right? So and if Mike Brown's jaywalking is a crime worthy of death, then we have this is a trouble, even more of a troubled country.
Claudia, I hear you there.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking as you were speaking was the fact that these neighborhoods are segregated because of redlining and various things. Those things come out of a racist system.
Right.
So it's not as if it's just that urban poor are targeted. It's why is it they are urban poor? That's the bigger question. How is it that the school system lost its funding when school systems in other neighborhoods didn't? All of those questions, I think, have to be addressed in the larger way. And also, the other way to think about it is if any of those people who were killed were white, in the situation that they were in, what would have been the reaction? Nobody's saying that Michael Brown is an angel. He was obviously a teenager acting out on the day that he was killed. But had he been a white teenager acting out in exactly the same way, would he have been murdered, and would his body have been left in the street for 4 hours? That, you know, so those are the kinds of questions I think should be asked. There is, many poor white people in this country as well. What is happening in their neighborhoods?
Yes, and I think in some of those neighborhoods, that's an open question, though some of the kind of almost horribly theatrical extreme, the body in the street for so many hours, that is a little hard to picture if the race were changed. But I don't know. It's not my neighborhood. I don't want to speak for it. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think that every time we start talking race relations, it's always swayed to one side. It's always the white person's fault. The black people don't have a chance and everything. And I don't totally agree with that. Here in Columbia, we had a single mother of four working midnight shift. She was killed by three black men who walked in and shot her. Now, there was no outcry for the single mother. There wasn't millions of dollars that poured in to support her four kids. But in the case of, for example, in Charleston, nine people get killed. It's considered a race killing. So millions of dollars have poured in for these families. I understand there's a race problem in America, but it's on both sides. It's not just white against blacks against whites, blacks against Mexicans against whites. It's across the board. But we're always focusing on one side. You cannot solve a problem by accusing one side as being the ultimate problem. The problem in America is single mothers, no father taking care of the kids, no fathers taking care of their the family. They're not even involved. Kids have no direction. NAACP in Chicago, what exactly do they do? Do they bring businesses in there? Do they support the local community where they give the chance? That's what NAACP is for, advancement for advancement. But you don't. All you hear is the cardboard papers with NAACP on it. You hear voices that come in when something happens.
James, we've got it. You say don't look at just one race, and I want to, if I may, and I appreciate your call, Claudia. As James tells that story of a young, and I see here. Or a white single mother killed, and you know, I don't know the details here, but you, Howard, you describe it. I wonder what you're thinking as he lays out and says, "Come on, let's think about everybody in this picture."
Well, again, it's again the same thing. You wonder, you know, this idea of neighborhood violence. Neighborhood violence happens across the board, mm-hmm. and. Poverty is there across the board, and it doesn't matter the race. The question is, when people are being killed and targeted in a way that is coming out of a specific targeted moment based on the color of their skin, that's a very different thing.
You're talking about police violence there in that case, not?
Well, police violence, but also the he brought up Charleston, the killing of the people in the church,
mass killing.
That you know that was terrorism. That was a targeted shooting of people in because they were black, simply because they were black, as opposed to neighborhood violence that comes out of. Whatever drives that.
It's interesting, DeRay. James is also saying, though, in a version maybe of what you're asking for, let's get into these communities and really address structural problems. Let's really deal with the economy. Let's really deal with family stress there.
Yeah, I think that what's troubling about what he said is that it reduces these issues to mere personal disagreements or mm-hmm. personal spats. Whereas racism in America, at least, has been deeply institutional, right? It was not like it wasn't one person saying, I'm going to deny this housing loan for this one person. It was like a system saying, like, black people are not going to get housing loan. You know, like, this was systemic. And so much of his arguments like that completely downplay just how intentional these systems were built to harm people of color, to disadvantage people of color. And then I'm always fascinated by how people extend that argument by focusing on the family is if I go to a couple PTA meetings and, you know, do a book club with my friends, that will actually just completely mitigate the fact that the school system's underfunded and, you know, like all those issues magically disappear when it's reduced to this notion of like if interpersonal things are better. So, yes, we should focus on strong families across the board. Right. We also need to deal with like what does it mean that there's a legacy of disadvantaging people. When you think about things like literacy, right? Like I'm a third generation reader. My great grandmother like only could sign her name. So when we think about like how do we address literacy in communities of color, we have to do it differently. You don't teach people how to read for 200 years and then you say everybody gets a book. Like that's not equity, you know? It sounds good, but it's not equity.
And also, why are those families broken? The question of incarceration around black males in this
correct.
Country has to be addressed. I mean, you cannot tell me, look at the single mothers and not also look at how those black men have ended up in jail.
Mm-hmm. DeRay, where do you see the Black Lives Matter movement going? When I look at the reporting on it, the tense of reference is all over the place. Some is, you know, present tense, some is past tense already. The movement has been or even was. Is it still on a full bore standing here? Where's it pointed? Where's it headed?
Yeah, so a couple of things. You know, I think that we spent the first sort of 7-8 months trying to get people to understand the issue and believe that it was closer to them than they thought it was, right? That it was not just St. Louis. It wasn't just Baltimore. It's actually your town, too. And I think about that as like the awareness and recognition phase. Then we moved to this phase about legitimacy. Like, are there real demands, right? And people were asking. And now I think that we're about to go into a phase that I think about two goals. One will be around people sort of challenging from the outside and changing from the inside. So I think we'll start to see people running for office and being on boards and sort of fighting on both the inside and outside. And I think there's a question around coalition building, right? Can we create entrances for people with whom we might not have shared goals but have shared outcomes? So you think about the gun control lobby, you put our goals together, the movement and the gun control lobby don't have the same goals, but we want to live in the same world. The climate change activists might not have the same goals, but we have the same outcomes. We want to live in a world where the water's not brown like it is in Flint, Michigan around disadvantaged people. So I think that those two things, the inside-outside game, the challenge from the outside, change from the inside, and then coalition building will likely be the next two main focuses of the movement.
And what about open hearts, open minds to a next step of change in this country, Claudia? Do you feel more resistance or more receptivity at this point?
I think there's more receptivity. I think that people are beginning to have a dialogue that means that there's no going back. I mean, you can on the one hand say, I see something, and then 10 minutes later say, I don't see it. So I think that we are moving forward in that.
On that front, with an open mind, maybe, with an open heart, we'll see. Something's laid out and acknowledged. You're right. It's hard to step away from it. No, we might try. So grateful on this Martin Luther King Day to have the two of you to talk through the moment with Claudia Rankin, terrific poet. Her latest collection is Citizen, an American Lyric, joining us today from Baltimore. Claudia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And DeRay McKesson, Black Lives Matter organizer, civil rights activist with us today from Washington, D.C. DeRay, good luck with your work, and thank you for your insights today.
Thanks for reminding me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's face it, when have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, the popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel Southern ladies, our family became an old West town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.